Michael Smithers will give argument for the citizens.
May it please the court, as I was introduced, I'm Michael Smithers from New Braunfels with the firm of Cornelius Powell and Smithers in New Braunfels. We represent the petitioners in this application, Mr. William Kindred and Ernest Kurtz. The case was filed in the 25th Judicial District Court in Lavaca County. Mr. Kindred, Mr. Kurtz were seeking recovery for personal injuries as a result of some burn injuries to them. The case was submitted to a jury. The theory of the petitioner's cause of action in the trial court was of products liability, specifically on theory of strict liability. No negligence cause of action, no breach of warranty cause of action, but strict liability. And under the strict liability cause of action, we had the two theories of marketing defect and design defect with this product, Con Kim's product by the name of Cono Prime X, and that was the theory of our lawsuit on which we tried the case to the jury. The case, as I said, was submitted to the jury there in Lavaca County. The court submitted our requested special issues on the marketing defect with regard to this product, Cono Prime X. The court, however, refused to submit our requested special issues with regard to the design defect that we alleged in with regard to the product Cono Prime X. The case went to the jury. The jury answered the marketing defect special issues that were submitted to it adversely to us. And at that point, we appealed to the Court of Appeals of the 13th Supreme Judicial District in Corpus. And the judgment of the trial court was affirmed by the Court of Appeals in Corpus. The one point of error that is before the court this morning, and the only point that was raised in the appeal before the Court of Appeals, was whether or not the Court of Appeals, or the court, the point of error at this point is whether the Court of Appeals erred in affirming the judgment of the trial court, because we contend there was evidence offered at trial to support the submission of our requested and tendered special issues on design defect. Now, the brief summary of the facts before we get into looking at some of the specific factual evidence that relates to what we say supports the issue. The petitioners, Mr. Kurtz and Mr. Kindred, were both employees of the Spetzel Brewery in Shiner, Texas. They were both employed there at the Shiner Brewery. They were in plant and maintenance. They were operating, their duties were to do various jobs related to maintaining the plant. Their specific job on that date of April 28, 1977 was to ready a beer storage tank for the application of an epoxy paint, which would provide a non-porous lining for this tank to ensure the quality of the product. They were applying to this storage tank this product in question, Cono Prime X, which is, in the chemical terminology, a primer or an intermediate between the lining of the steel of the tank and the epoxy paint that was to go on. They were preparing the surface to make it more acceptable to this epoxy paint so it would stay on the tank longer and not peel off. They were working inside of a large beer storage tank that they entered through a small manhole cover. They were using breathing air masks to prevent breathing any of the vapors that they were of this product, Cono Prime X. They were applying this to the entire surface of the storage tank. And the vapor concentration from this product, Cono Prime X, was built up naturally as it's applied in a thin coat to the inside of this tank. The vapor concentration builds up. And the evidence on trial shows that this product was one which contained a flammable solvent. It was 95% solvent, 5% of an active ingredient, so to speak, that helped provide this bond between the metal and the epoxy paint. And the solvent was used as a carrier to make this application easy and then evaporate off and leave the very thin layer of this intermediate binder, if you will. The product was being applied in that manner when an ignition occurred and a fire occurred in that storage tank. Both of Mr. Kurtz and Mr. Kindred, before they could exit the manhole cover and get out of that storage tank in that fire, they were both burned and suffered burn injuries as a result of that fire that occurred in the storage tank on that date. Now, the special issues, again, that were tendered to the jury, as I had indicated before, were on marketing defect theory and on design defect theory. The marketing defects theories were submitted to the jury. The trial judge refused the design defect theories. The law that's applicable with regard to whether we are entitled to the submission of that issue on design defect is a three-pronged test, as I believe the law reflects. And that is, did we properly plead a design defect theory of recovery? Did we tender a proper special issue to the court for submission? And then, was there evidence to support the submission of that special issue? There does not seem to be, and there is no dispute, and as the Court of Appeal points out in its decision, there is no dispute that we properly pled the design defect theory of recovery. There's no dispute that we properly tendered the special issue in substantially correct form, because we in fact tracked the issue that this court had set out in the Turner case and submitted it in that form to the court for submission. However, the Court of Appeals, of course, bases its decision on the fact that there was no evidence, or only a mere scintilla of evidence, therefore no evidence to support the submission of the issue. And of course, we contend that there was not only more than a scintilla, but there was a considerable amount of evidence to support our submission of the issue on design defect, and in fact it was error for it not to have been submitted. And in my brief, I state and list the authorities for the proposition as follows, that if there is evidence to support the special issues, a special issue to be submitted to the jury, then the trial court's refusal to submit that issue is reversible error. Second, the trial court may refuse to submit a special issue only if there is no evidence to support that special issue. Thirdly, if the proof offered with regard to the requested special issue is more than a mere scintilla, then the trial court must submit the special issue. And fourthly, the factual insufficiency of the evidence with regard to that requested special issue is no basis on which the trial court can refuse to submit that special issue. That is the law as I understand it, and as cited in my brief, and of which I understand that the respondent in his answer has cited no cases to the contrary, and I think that the only issue that he disputes is what was that evidence, not what the law is with regard to the matter of submission of that issue, as I just stated. Now, obviously this is as I said, a products liability case based in strict liability. And of course, this court has written many times on the issue of strict liability and design defect, and in fact had written relatively shortly before this case was tried in the case of Turner versus General Motors on the question of how do you submit an issue on design defect. And of course had written in the Boatman case citing again the Turner case and again pointing out the matters to be proven and the way to submit an issue on design defect. And in fact, in my brief, and I would like to read it merely for the fact that I think it's the important language that we were looking at when we put on our proof and when we submitted our special issues on design defect, where this court said, quoting from Boatland, saying, in the Turner versus General Motors case, this court discussed the strict liability standard of defectiveness as applied in design defect cases. Whether a product was defectively designed requires a balancing by the jury of its utility against the likelihood of and gravity of injury from its use. The jury may consider many factors before deciding whether a product's usefulness or desirability are outweighed by its risks. Their finding on defectiveness may be influenced by evidence of a safer design that would have prevented the injury. They're citing the authorities. Because defectiveness of the product in question is determined in relation to safer alternatives, the fact that its risks could be diminished easily or cheaply may greatly influence the outcome of the case. And it was with that understanding of the law that we submitted the issues on design defect after having put on the proof, which we did on the design of the product. And in my brief, or in the application before this court, and in my brief in the Court of Appeals, I highlighted some of the evidence that we contend certainly supports the submission of the issue of design defect. And that evidence is, and I think it's certainly important for me to go over that because this is the key to the entire case, and that is this some evidence of the defective design of the product? Because if this is some evidence, then the Court of Appeals erred in refusing to submit our issue with regard to design defect. One of the first pieces of evidence that I referred to and that was introduced in this cause was from our expert witness, and that was Dr. Morris Key. And his testimony is the only testimony from any expert that we have in this case. In fact, the defendant, the respondent, ConChem Inc., did not introduce any evidence from its corporate people, chemists, management, or any expert witness. The only evidence was that of the petitioners. And our expert witness, Dr. Key, was the only expert to testify. He certainly, first of all, testified that the product, Conno Prime X, was flammable. There was no question that it was flammable, not disputed. It was also undisputed that the only flammable product present in the storage tank where the fire occurred was that product, Conno Prime X. The brewmaster, the petitioners themselves, testified that that was it. It was not contradicted that it was the only flammable material there in the storage tank where the fire occurred. Thirdly, the fire in the storage tank resulted from the ignition of the vapors of Conno Prime X from an unidentified ignition source. This is in the statement of facts on page 30 of Dr. Key's testimony. At that point, he's talking about on page 30 itself, he's talking about the ignition source itself, saying it's unidentified. But the prior cross-examination by respondents' counsel all was with regard to the flammable nature of this solvent, and more particularly that component that evaporates and leaving this flammable mixture. And this is what he was talking about and testifying to at that point in the statement of facts. Number four, the injuries of petitioners were the result of the fire in the storage tank. Obviously, that's the petitioner's testimony, the doctor's testimony, and there's no contradicting evidence from the respondent again. Fifthly, the product Conno Prime X applied inside a storage tank would result in a very dangerous, very flammable mixture. That is Dr. Key's testimony from from the statement of facts, page 13, 15, and 53 of that statement of facts. the manufacturer should have foreseen the use of the product ConoPrime-X in a confined space where flammable concentrations would exist. And that is, again, Dr. Key's testimony at page 16 of the Statement of Facts. They should have known. In fact, they're the ones that said, use this product for this application, knowing it was being used in a storage tank. They not only foresaw that, they even advertised the product as doing the job for that application, knowing that they had a flammable solvent system and still said use the product for that application. The product ConoPrime-X could have been designed more safely by using alternate, safe, and non-flammable solvents, such as water or halogenated hydrocarbons, without impairing the function or utility of the product. Dr. Key testifies exactly as that says on page 20 and 21 of the Statement of Facts. They could have made it safer. Not only could have, he later says they should have. It was defective because they didn't. There are a number of safe alternatives. Water would have been a safe solvent. A halogenated hydrocarbon would have been a safe non-flammable solvent. All of these are safer alternatives for the design of that product, as he testified to. And then ninth, the testimony concerning the cost of producing a safer alternative to the product, ConoPrime-X, was not established in an exact amount, but the testimony indicating that a suitable flammable, non-flammable solvent water would have been cheaper than the present solvent mixture, that is the alcohol mixture, and that the silane compound, this compound present in that 5% concentration that acted as the binder carried by that solvent system, would be more expensive, but it was only in a 5% concentration as compared to 95% of this carrier solvent, which in the case of water, is a cheaper solvent. This testimony on the cost of the safer alternative was not fully developed by Dr. Key. But what he did refer to there was on page 58 and page 60 of the Statement of Facts. And I certainly submit to the court that on that question of a cheaper alternative, that I think it's the respondent's responsibility, and they have the wherewithal, if it's available to them, to point out what problems there would be with this safer alternative. But the scientific availability of a safer alternative is unquestioned at all. There's no question of that. Now, certainly, I think that this case, the issue in this case is very narrow, but there's certainly a lot of law that is somewhat complex and that I do not purport to fully, completely understand with regard to this design defect theory of products liability. But it certainly seems to me that we have introduced more than a mere scintilla. In fact, I think we've introduced overwhelming evidence of the fact that this product is defectively designed when you consider the risk involved with regard to the utility of the product. The respondent points out that, well, this product could have been used safely in another application. Well, I don't think that and Dr. Key himself says, if you have a situation involving adequate ventilation, then you may not have a problem with this product. But you have to look at design defect in the context of the normal intended uses of the product. And it is unquestionable that this was one of the normal intended uses of that product. They advertised it that way. They promoted it that way. It was intended for that specific use. But it was certainly not acceptable for that use. It was dangerous. It was a defective product when used in that normal intended use. And there's certainly a lot of evidence, the only evidence, supports just that conclusion. And I think that's the fact that we introduced some evidence of feasibility of an alternate safe design. We did so, that we introduced evidence of an alternate safe design. Now, I think, as I indicated earlier, the responsibility to develop the feasibility of that alternate safe design, as far as the production of it, is not our responsibility. It's not something that is a burden to be carried by a plaintiff in a strict liability design defect situation. I think that from the evidence that was introduced, all of the things that I've enumerated specifically, there is certainly sufficient evidence for the fact that the trial court should have submitted this design defect issue that we submitted in the form that this court indicated in the Turner case. And the producing cause issue was also properly submitted in the same language. And there was evidence adduced on each one of those issues. Certainly, we don't even have to say at this point that there was sufficient evidence. We think there was overwhelming evidence. But the point is that there was evidence. And it's certainly more than just a mere scintilla. Therefore, the court was required to submit that special issue to the jury, and it was reversible error when the court did not. And therefore, we are saying that the judgment of the Court of Appeals should be reversed, that of the trial court reversed, and petitioners granted a new trial with regard to this cause of action.
Thank you, Counselor. We will hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Kevin McCullen will give argument to the respondent.
May it please the court?
Counsel.
Your Honor, as I've been introduced, my name is Kevin Cullen. I'm an attorney in Victoria, Texas, and I am the attorney for the respondent, Conchem, Inc., in this cause of action. Our position is, I think, adequately stated or characterized by our two reply points in our reply to the petitioner's application for writ of error. The first point is that there was no evidence before the trial court that the design of our product, ConoPrime X, was unreasonably dangerous. The second point, or the second reply point, is that there was no evidence before the trial court, that vapors or fumes from our product, ConoPrime X, were a producing cause of the fire and thus the petitioner's injuries. I'd like to try to take the points one at a time, and I think that would be a little more orderly. In order for the petitioners to be entitled to a submission in a products case on a design theory, there are three elements which they must introduce some evidence on. The first element is that the product is defective. The second is that the defectiveness of the product renders it unreasonably dangerous. And the third is that this defect, which is unreasonably dangerous, is a producing cause of the injury suffered by the petitioners. There is evidence, and there was evidence, it was Dr. Key's testimony, that the product was defective. He testified to the bare issue of the product being defective. It is our position that there is no evidence that the defectiveness rendered the product unreasonably dangerous and that it was a producing cause of the injuries. The petitioners have set out in both their motion for rehearing before the Court of Appeals and their application for writ of error to the court here, various pieces of evidence which they believe or they contend are some evidence of that the product was unreasonably dangerous as designed. I believe from those points, the pieces of evidence which they believe show that are that the use of the product, Dr. Key testified that the use of the product in a confined area could result in a very dangerous situation. Secondly, that a safer, less flammable alternative to our product could have been designed, and thirdly, that the product itself was defective. The part about the product being defective, as I've already discussed, goes to the one element of defectiveness, but not to the element of unreasonable dangers, whether or not the product was unreasonably dangerous as designed. In order to be entitled to that submission of those issues, he must show both defectiveness and unreasonably dangerous. It's our contention that he did not do that. Dr. Morris Key, was a chemist, and he was petitioner's expert, and the petitioners are correct in that the respondents did not have an expert at the time of his trial, and that the only expert whose testimony was before the court was Dr. Key. Dr. Key testified that the use of the product Conoprime X in a confined area would result or could result in a very dangerous situation. In that same answer, he also testified that if the product was used outside where the vapors could be carried away and diluted more readily, it would not be as nearly as dangerous, and that there is no warning to that effect. That was the answer. I believe that's on page 30 of his testimony. Dr. Key did not testify that the product as designed was unreasonably dangerous, but testified that its use in a particular instance without adequate ventilation could result in a very dangerous situation. In essence, what the doctor was saying was that without adequate warnings of how to properly use the product then becomes dangerous. He couched his answer, or limited his answer, about the product, the use in a confined area being very dangerous, in saying that there are no warnings to that effect. In addition, he later testified that the use of the product by other breweries would be no problem, that it would work just fine so long as there is adequate ventilation and the vapor hazard is taken care of. He's not testifying that the product is unreasonably dangerous as designed, but that the failure to warn of this vapor hazard was unreasonably dangerous. If we look at...
Was there a warning?
Yes and no, Your Honor. There was a warning on the package that the cans of Conoprime X were contained in. There may have been a use tag or an instruction booklet tag on the cans, but so far as a label on the can which said this product is extremely flammable, use adequate ventilation, there was none, as I understand the
evidence. Is there testimony about the uses of this product? Is there testimony as to what people ordinarily use this kind of a product for?
There is no testimony, Your Honor, as to what people ordinarily use this product for, but I think it can certainly be inferred from the evidence that was admitted that the use in a confined area like this was foreseeable, or not only that it could, has to be used inside a tank, it could be used on metal walls, it can be used outside, as Dr. Key testified.
Was there evidence that it's one of its uses was to coat the inside tank?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. And what our position is not that there was no evidence on failure to warn. The judge submitted issues on failure to warn or on the marketing defect aspect of the product's liability theory, and we are not contending that that was improper. There certainly, if I may say in retrospect, there should have been a warning on that. The court submitted an issue on that, and the jury answered it adversely to the petitioners. But what we're saying is that it's this failure to warn that makes the product unreasonably dangerous, not its design.
Counselor, am I correct in my recollection that this substance had a flash point of 53 degrees Fahrenheit?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it was recommended by your company that it be used inside storage tanks.
Yes and no, Your Honor. It was not recommended use this inside of a storage tank, but it was not prohibited. It was not. We did not say don't use it inside a storage tank. I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
Well, what would be the difference between putting that product on the market, and you, as you said a minute ago, with foreseeability that it would be used inside storage tanks where the accumulation of fumes would occur? What would be the difference between that and putting an automobile on the market with a defective design brakes, and say you always on level ground and drive 5 miles an hour, it's not dangerous, but if you go 50 miles an hour on the hill, then those brakes are going to get to you. What's the difference?
Because, Your Honor, as Dr. Key testified, the difference is that this product can be used safely.
Well, that
it can
be used safely in certain circumstances.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think that that is a very limited circumstance that would totally destroy the utility of the automobile. That, you know, if all you could do is drive 5 miles an hour on level ground, the automobile in essence has no utility. You just didn't walk. In this situation with the Conoprime X, you can, if the ventilation is adequate, even inside a storage tank, the product is safe. Dr. Key, the petitioner's expert, testified that the use in other breweries inside tanks should cause no problem so long as there's adequate ventilation. Again, what the doctor is getting at is that it's not the danger does not arise from the design, but from the failure to provide adequate ventilation, which he maintained and the petitioners maintained we did not advise the user or take adequate steps to advise the user of that danger. The petitioners in the case brought the case under two theories of liability, the marketing defect and the design defect. And I think that as you review all of the evidence in the court and in before the trial court, and in particular the evidence Dr. Key's testimony, you can see that all of the evidence is geared towards, and the thrust of the petitioner's case was, failure to warn. Not, it was not geared on the effect of, this is a design defect. It's all geared toward failure to warn. This is, can create a dangerous situation, and nobody warned about that, did they? No. The doctor then testifies, well, it could be used safely if there be adequate ventilation.
Counsel, there is some testimony. Question was asked, could the product even be designed with a solvent system that was not flammable? An answer could have been, it's a question. Yes, yes. And then, doctor, in your opinion, does the failure to use a less flammable solvent system in this application and so forth, does that constitute a defect in that design of that product? Answer, in my opinion, yes. So defect design was part of the case, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, it was. And there is, that is sufficient evidence on the element of defective design.
I get your argument there, okay. But when you make the statement that this was, that the issue was not in the case about defect as distinguished from marketing, why it would seem that the issue of defect was in the lawsuit. I'm not saying it was proved.
Okay. I would agree, Your Honor, that it was in the lawsuit. What I was getting at was that the thrust and the real direction of plaintiffs, of the petitioner's case, was toward marketing defect, failure to warn, and not towards design defect. And I'm not trying to tell this court that had the petitioners introduced other evidence, they could not have proved or gotten sufficient evidence into the record that would show that this would entitle them to a submission on a design defect. What I'm saying is that they didn't introduce that evidence if it exists.
Well, they have detailed this much evidence. I'd just like to have your evaluation. While you're here, I can ask you. I can't ask you tomorrow. But there is evidence that it's got a low flash point, 53. That's pretty cold. That's colder than it is in here. And there is evidence that that flash point will inflame fumes, causing a fire. Now, Do you think that a jury from that could infer that that was an unreasonable danger, something that would cause a fire?
No, Your Honor. That standing alone, I do not think would be sufficient evidence for a jury, nor sufficient evidence for the court to submit the issue. I think if you carry that analogy one step further, what you would be doing would be equating flammability with unreasonably dangerous, as that term is understood in products liability law. In essence, what you're then saying is gasoline, for example. The doctor testified gasoline was flammable. That gasoline is, as designed, unreasonably dangerous. There are substitutes for gasoline. You can use diesel. It's not as flammable. You can use electricity as an alternate source of power as opposed to gasoline. Gasoline's use in a confined area is also foreseeable. Everyone stores their cans of gasoline in a garage or a storage shed.
If you store gasoline in a garage, your insurance is automatically canceled. Always set your gasoline tank out under the eaves of the house.
Your Honor, I understand that, but nevertheless, the manufacturers and producers of gasoline will foresee that people are going to store gasoline in a garage or a shed. And that that could also create, and I'm sure Dr. Key would have testified, that would create a very dangerous situation. That does not mean that gasoline as designed is unreasonably dangerous. What it may mean is that the manufacturers and makers of cans or containers in which gasoline is stored should have warnings on the cans that say, store in a well-ventilated area. Do not use in a confined space. But not that the design of gasoline is defective. Perhaps the cans that hold them ought to have a warning. But not that the gasoline itself, the design of it, is defective. And in essence, I think that indicates where the emphasis is on in our position in this case. The petitioner's other piece of evidence, and that Your Honor referred to a minute ago, had to do with this safer design alternative. And it's our position that there was no evidence of feasibility of this design alternative, and that without evidence of feasibility, that it amounts to no evidence. This was the holding of the Court of Appeals. Now, there is some evidence, and I'm using that term incorrectly. There is less than a scintilla of evidence, or there were some testimony about feasibility. But it amounts to no more than a surmise or a suspicion. It's speculative and as such constitutes no evidence. And that testimony is with regard to the 95% component being less expensive, but the 5% component being more expensive. I think that to go and take the next assumption, or the assumption that the petitioners urge, that therefore the product would be less expensive. I think you're ignoring two real facts, and one is we don't know the degrees or the extent that one is more expensive or less expensive, nor do we know what the cost of manufacturing this product would be. I think that we would be extremely naive if we believed that all we had to do was take two materials and pour them together and we've got this primer. I mean, there is a manufacturing expense cost, a production cost. I don't know how to do that, but there was no evidence on that. And there was just no evidence that whether it would cost more, how much more, whether it would cost less, or how much less. And in determining unreasonably dangerous, and particularly when we're talking about a safer alternative, and granted, that is some evidence, you must have not only the risk of harm in our balancing aspect or our balancing test, but also the utility of the product and its cost. And if you don't have the cost, then you don't have anything to balance it against. All you show is that we can eliminate the harm, but if we don't show what our cost is or what our expense is in doing that, then that evidence is of little value, as the Court of Appeals stated, and as such is no evidence. Or no more than a scintilla of evidence. The product is unreasonably dangerous.
Counsel, I don't want to beat this point to death, but
if you advertise that this product can be used inside of tanks, to coat the inside of tanks, you are, in effect, inviting the purchaser to do exactly that. True, the product used outside is not unreasonably dangerous. But when used inside, may become unreasonably dangerous without proper ventilation. I think we would all agree that there's no need to warn of a product that's not unreasonably dangerous. But if you take it inside that tank and it becomes a potential problem, then you got to warn about it. But you the reason you warn about it is because when you get it inside the tank, it's unreasonably dangerous.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. It's unreasonably dangerous without the adequate ventilation. If you have the ventilation, as Dr. Key testified, then you would have no problem.
What does the evidence show was the purpose for which this product is manufactured? To paint the inside of the tanks, or does it have other uses?
It has other uses, Your Honor. There is not a lot of evidence as to other uses. The real evidence is that it is a primer, a multi-purpose primer, in essence. Something that is applied, whether it be, I assume, in this instance, to metal, so that you may paint on metal and the metal will not peel off easily or as easily. And I'm reasonably certain that it has many other uses than the inside of coating the inside of beer tanks. I don't believe that there is any evidence before the court that says that this was its intended use. This is the only use that the product was designed for.
Well, would you go so far or not go so far as to say that use of this product both inside and outside was foreseeable?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Counselor, would you say that carburetor in Thompson versus General Motors would not have been defective because it could have been used on a stationary motor as a power source for some operation that's supposed to put on an automobile?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Well, would you explain the difference in what you've been...
Well, I'm not sure. I think that carburetor, is this the carburetor that stuck open and allowed the... I think that carburetor that is going to stick open all the time or is going to stick open some of the time regardless of the use to which it is put, is a different type of product than we have with ConoPrime-X, which can be used without having any of the problems.
Well,
it will not fail, if that's a proper term, if it is used correctly.
I think the defectiveness in that carburetor was established by use in an automobile at a certain speed, et cetera, wasn't it? As opposed to sitting in a stationary place, running at an even speed?
Again, I think, Your Honor, that when you get back to the automobile, well, then you're cutting down on its utility. And I would think that would not be a design defect if there was the warning to the effect that if you approach a speed of 50 miles an hour, you know, if the vehicle sold for the intended purpose of not being driven over this certain speed, and if it is driven over the certain speed, then they realize the risk. That's not analogous to this situation for the reason that we can use this product, ConoPrime-X, in all instances, in all places. It can be used inside a storage tank, whereas this vehicle, the carburetor, cannot be driven over whatever speed without incurring risk. There's not something you can do to prevent that carburetor from sticking. With ConoPrime-X, you can prevent the problem by supplying adequate ventilation. In the carburetor case, you cannot prevent the problem. In this situation, you can prevent a dangerous situation from arising by supplying adequate ventilation. I think that's